A newspaper reporter once asked Abraham Lincoln how he felt about losing an important election in New York. Lincoln replied with characteristic humour that he felt rather like the boy who stubbed his toe while running to meet his sweetheart. "Too big to cry," he said, "and far too badly hurt to laugh." I guess we all know that kind of feeling, don't we? One way or another, of stubbing our toe and feeling like crying about it. We've studied for an exam, perhaps, so hard, and we confidently await the results, and then comes that nasty, stiff brown envelope through the mail, and the news that we've failed it. Or we paid for that holiday, and we were dreaming of those sun-drenched beaches. Then comes the long-anticipated fortnight, and it never stops raining from one week's end to the next. Or we're expecting a child, and we're happy buying the nappies and the cot for the nursery. Then comes the moment of delivery in the hospital and the tragic discovery: he's handicapped. Disappointment is something we all have to learn to cope with. Whether, like Lincoln, we feel we're too big to cry about it or not, we certainly know what it's like to be too badly hurt by disappointment to laugh it off. It all happens, of course, because we're basically optimistic, most of us. We set our hearts upon that happy ending that fairy stories always seem to conclude with. But in real life, it doesn't always work out like that, does it? Alexander Pope once composed a rather cynical beatitude to just that effect. "Blessed is he who expects nothing," he wrote. "He shall never be disappointed." But then that wouldn't be human, would it? To expect nothing. Computers may be satisfied with just predicting the future, but it's in the nature of us human beings to actively look forward to the future, to become emotionally engaged in its unrealized possibilities. Well, the cynic may be right when he says expecting things is a gamble. That's true, but then it's a gamble without which our lives would be immeasurably impoverished. From that day in childhood when we first learn to count off the days leading up to Christmas, we're creatures of hope. Creatures for whom anticipation is at least half the joy of existence. And that being so, disappointment is a form of suffering to which we are inevitably vulnerable. See, the blanks, as well as the prizes, have to be drawn in the lottery of life. And when we draw one, it disappoints us. Now, you might think, I suppose, that that's one of the advantages of being God, that you never have to experience being let down like that. After all, God is omniscient. He can see the future with absolute certainty. And God's omnipotent, so he can control the future absolutely infallibly. It's only, as Robbie Burns says, mice and men whose best-laid schemes go askew, leaving us with nights of grief and pain instead of the promised joy. But God's plans can't miscarry in that way. The Bible itself says he works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his own will. When did God ever stub his toe? Surely he's not only too big to cry, he's so big he never has to cry. Disappointment is one experience with which deity simply can't sympathize. At least, so you would have thought, wouldn't you? And yet the unexpected message of our Bible study this morning is that such a conclusion would be wrong, or at least grossly oversimplified. See, Hosea had come to realize that Jehovah, the God of Israel, really loved his people. And he wanted them to love him. But love isn't something that can be coerced by a mere exercise of power or by the strength of will, is it? Hosea himself had learned that from the bitter experience of his own broken marriage. Now, love must be a free response. And because it's free, love is something that can always be denied, even to omnipotence. And that's what Israel was doing. Though God loved her, she had rejected his advances. She turned to other sport, to the idols of the pagan nations round about. And as Hosea knew only too well, there is no disappointment in the whole world quite so intense as the pangs of such an unrequited love. Sure, the God of the Bible's never taken by surprise, but Hosea wants to teach us this morning that that doesn't mean he can never be hurt. Sure, the God of the Bible is so big, he is never reduced to helplessness. But Hosea wants us to learn this morning that that doesn't mean he's too big, never to be reduced to tears. Sure, the God of the Bible is never thwarted. But Hosea wants us to know this morning that that does not mean he can never be disappointed. This morning I want us to identify three things in this passage that we read which lay at the heart of that divine disappointment with Israel. Let me tell you what they are. First of all, there was the shallowness of their worship in verses 3 to 6 of chapter 6. Secondly, there was the corruption of their society in chapter 6, verse 7, through to 7, verse 7. And then there was the ingratitude of their attitude in chapter 7, verses 8 to 16. All right, the shallowness of their religion, or their worship, first of all. Look back at the beginning of our reading, at verse 4 of chapter 6. What can I do with you, Ephraim, we find God saying. What can I do with you, Judah? I guess all of us who are parents have sometimes wrung our hands and said things like that, haven't we? I don't know what I'm going to do with him. I'm at my wits' end trying to cope with her. Well, Hosea pictures God in a similar state of exasperation. Try as he may, nothing seems to produce in Israel the kind of spiritual response he's looking for. In spite of his omnipotence, God himself finds himself feeling frustrated by them and their obstinacy. It wasn't, of course, that religion was unpopular in the country. On the contrary, as we've learned in earlier studies, the shrines of Israel were packed with enthusiastic pilgrims. But for all the apparent vigor of Israel's interest in spiritual things, in going to church, it just didn't come up to God's expectations. He found himself permanently disappointed by the shallowness of their spirituality. Notice the things that contributed to that. First of all, it was the inconsistency of their religion. Your love is like the morning mist, he says, like the early dew that disappears. You know, just as children go through phases. So Israel had her periodic bouts of intense religiosity. But it never lasted, you see. It was always just a temporary fad, a passing fashion. She could sing pious words with every appearance of sincerity when she wanted to. Words like this penitential psalm that chapter 6 begins with and that we looked at last week. Let us acknowledge the Lord, verse 3. Let's press on to acknowledge him. As surely as the sun rises, he will appear. As such earnest aspirations towards revival were never more than a five-minute wonder, says Hosea. Notice the ironic echo between verse 3 and 4. As surely as the sun rises, God will appear, eh, Israel? No, the truth of the matter is, as surely as the sun rises, your protestations of devotion will disappear, like the morning mist, like the condensation on the lawn. Your commitment to God just evaporates into the hot air of cant and hypocrisy, which is all it is. Just inconsistent. More than that, though, their religion was also, he says, unteachable. Verse 5, therefore I cut you in pieces with my prophets. I killed you with the words of my mouth. My judgments flashed like lightning upon you. They were like children who've been told a dozen times by their parents to do something and still take no notice. May God repeatedly rebuke the Israelites. See, that rebuke could come in two ways, through the words of the prophets and through acts of judgment. May well be, I think, that Hosea has in mind the period of Ahab a century before, when famine had devastated the land and Elijah had challenged the people with their double-mindedness. Why do you halt between two opinions, he says. If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal, follow him. And Elijah, you may recall, finished up by cutting the prophets of Baal into pieces. Now, it wasn't as if these warnings of history had been restrained or temperate in their tone. God's prophets had let the Israelites have it right between the eyes. I killed you with the words of my mouth. I cut you in pieces with my prophets, he says. His judgments had been so obvious, it was as though they had lit up the sky, flashed like lightning upon you, he says. And yet it had all been ignored. No one took any notice. Oh, a flurry of old-time religious sentimentality, perhaps, but then it was back to the old idolatry again. Israel was incorrigible, a delinquent people, even when God himself was wielding the disciplinary birch. But supremely, God's disappointment lies in verse 6, with the superficiality of their religion. I desire mercy, he says, not sacrifice. The acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. See, the Israelites believed at this time basically in a sacramentalist religion. Sacrifices and burnt offerings, that's what worship meant for them. A set of ceremonial duties that you did in the prescribed way and which were supposed to guarantee that God would be on your side. They liked liturgies and choirs and incense and processions and pomp and ceremony. Religion for them was all about creating an atmosphere of the mysterious and the transcendent. Through the hocus-pocus of their priestly ritual. The sanctuary was a kind of theatre, really, where religious drama was performed for the entertainment and for the encouragement of the worshippers. Now, of course, it'd be quite wrong to say that that sacramental dimension of religion is wrong. If there's anything false about it, on the contrary, these burnt offerings, these sacrifices, they were commanded by God. But the trouble with Israel was it didn't go any deeper than that. Formal ritual, that's all it was. But God is looking for something altogether more demanding. Mercy, he says, not sacrifice. The acknowledgement of God, not burnt offerings. These two words, mercy and the acknowledgement of God, these are key words in Hosea's vocabulary. They keep coming back again and again, you probably noticed that. Because they speak of that personal response to God, which is Hosea's great burden. He wants people to relate to God as a wife relates to a husband, with love and commitment. God is looking for a personal relationship with us, he's saying. One that lasts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's what he means by religion. A relationship that expresses itself in secret devotion, not just in public ceremony. In moral choices, not just sacramental observances. 8 centuries later, a greater even than Hosea would chide the formal religion of his day in precisely the same manner. Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners, the Pharisees demanded. Go learn what this means, Jesus replied. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And that's a very searching lesson for the church today. People all over the city this very day are going to be going to church. The central churches in Cambridge, I guarantee, will be packed as they always are on Sunday morning. What are those people going for? Some will go to take communion, believing that consecrated bread and wine has some magical property to make them right with God. Some will go to hear the choir, believing that sacred music carries some kind of benefit to the soul, as well as aesthetic enjoyment to the ears. Some will go to participate in a spiritual rave-up, believing that emotional catharsis is the same thing as acceptable worship. Yes, and some will go to listen to a sermon, of course, believing that enduring the tedium of 45 minutes of Bible study conveys some kind of spiritual merit. But the sad thing is, they're all wrong. Their religion, for all its apparent fervour, is shallow. It's inconsistent, for one thing. Many of them, it's nothing more than a passing phase or a Sunday routine. It's unteachable, because the one thing you can be absolutely sure of is that they will go in and out of that church and not have learned a thing, not have changed an iota. And it's always superficial. concentrating on religious performance, to the neglect of having real personal dealings with a living God. Dare I ask you why you're here this morning? What's brought you along to this church? Are you saying by your presence here, well, you know, I'm a middle-class, respectable, Christian family person? Are you saying, I enjoy the intellectual stimulation of a Bible lecture? Are you saying, going to church always makes me feel good about myself for the rest of the week? What are you saying? Are you saying you want to know what it means to love God? To know Him? Because that's the only reason He wants to see you in church, you know. Any other motive is a disappointment to Him. Maybe there are many of us that He's shrugging His shoulders in exasperation about this morning and saying, what can I do with you, Ephraim? What can I do with you? Your love is like the morning mist. I desire mercy, not church going. So the superficiality, the shallowness of their religion, that was the first thing that disappointed God, we learned from our passage. The second thing was the corruption, the moral corruption of their society. The key verse here that I want you to fix on is at the beginning of chapter 7. Whenever I would restore the fortunes of my people, whenever I would heal Israel, the sins of Ephraim are exposed and the crimes of Samaria revealed. You get once again that note of divine frustration. Whenever I want to be merciful to them, something gets in the way. One of the most important things that's happened to our society in the last couple of centuries is what the sociologists call secularization. I've spoken about it before. It's the word they use to describe the way in which Christianity, which used to be the central influence upon our laws and social institutions, has been progressively squeezed out of the center of things and pushed more and more into the margins of life. I think there's been a pretty good illustration, actually, of the sort of thing I'm talking about in the news this week. That controversial Law Lords decision on the case of Mrs. Sheila Gillick. I'm not suggesting that the question of parental consent to the supply of contraceptives to young people under the age of 16 is an easy one. In fact, knowing as I do several Christians who work with young people in the inner city, I'm rather relieved, actually, by the House of Lords decision this week. For as passionately as I support Mrs. Gillick's insistence that it's the families, not the doctors, still less the young person themselves, that ought to take responsibility for the sexual behaviour of those under the age of consent, I think we have to face the reality that in a society where emotional deprivation of children and adolescent alienation is as common as it is now in ours, it's just unrealistic to expect the family to exercise that kind of responsibility in an awful lot of cases. And the sad truth is that very young children most likely to engage in precocious sexual behaviour are also likely to come from the very families least able to exercise any kind of guardianship over them. And though I suspect that many evangelicals will be raising their hands in horror at the reversal of that previous Gillick decision, I can't honestly say I'm one of them. Nevertheless, I have been distressed by that case. Not so much distressed by the verdict the Law Lords came to. What distresses me is that this whole issue seems to have been debated without any real consideration of the moral issues involved, without any real thought of the outrage, the scandal which it ought to be for us to admit that such an issue is one for our society. That young people have to be protected from the age of puberty upwards against pregnancy. It seems that that's a given. Everybody's assumed, well, that's the case, of course. And all we can spend our time debating about is how they should get their contraceptives. The largest moral and ethical issue of the moral damage that's being done to children, if that is the case in our society, seems to have slipped by unnoticed. I mean, are we really pretending that a 12-year-old can have sex with a 14-year-old and be in no danger? If so, then why are we bothered about sexual abuse of children? Why do we have a legal age of consent? And why not just legitimize paedophilia and have done with it? Now, as a society, we are in total confusion about the nature and purpose of sex. All we can talk about is the pragmatics of contraception. It's pathetic. It's sad. And the root of that confusion is secularization. The loss of the Bible's influence on the morals and manners of our people. Now, something similar was going on in Israel, you see. Look what he says in verse 7 of chapter 6. Like Adam, he says, they have broken the covenant. Now, opinions differ as to whether that's a reference to Adam the man or a place Adam that existed in Israel. But the important thing about the verse is the indictment it contains. They've broken the covenant. That's how God puts it. See, the law of God isn't some optional extra which we can pay attention to if we feel like it or happen to agree with it. The law of God comes to us as a contractual obligation expressing God's sovereign rule over our lives. Just as emperors in the ancient world would impose treaties upon their subject people, so God establishes his covenant with men and women. I will bless you, he says, but there are moral obligations. You must keep my covenant law. That's the way it's always expressed. And so long as people feel themselves accountable to that divine authority over their lives, moral values can be sustained in a society to a very large degree by voluntary self-regulation. You do not need vast police forces or wasteful bureaucracies to keep your eye on people. So long as people in general feel moral law comes from above and has an absolute claim to their obedience, society will be basically law-abiding. But once secularization sets in for any length of time, once people begin to think that the religious dimension to life is a dispensable one, then the foundation upon which that voluntary, self-regulated pattern of moral discipline was built just collapses. Who says so? That's the question they ask, and the answer is nobody. It's a case of every man does what's right in his own eyes. And the result in Israel was plain to see. Mob violence, for a start. Look at verses 8 and 9 of chapter 6. Gilead is a city of wicked men, stained with the footprints of blood. Isn't that a vivid way of putting it? And you know, even the clergy were involved. As marauders lie in ambush for a man, so do bands of priests. They murder on the road to Shechem. Not so unimaginable when you remember that one of the Borgias got to be pope. Violence was all over the place in Israel, and so was this obsession with sex. I have seen a horrible thing in the house of Israel. Ephraim is given to prostitution, he says. It really matters little whether Hosea is using the word prostitution there literally of the sexual immorality in his society, or as a metaphor for the idolatry of Baal that he often calls spiritual adultery, because they were really two sides of the same coin. Israel was just becoming a society where people worshipped sex, thought little else, from morning till night. And you see what God's verdict is on that state of affairs. I have seen a horrible thing, he says. It was a scandal to him. It outraged him. One has doubts whether the seared moral vision of many in Israel saw it that way. One has doubts whether many in Britain see the decline in sexual ethics in our society as that. I have seen a horrible thing. But that's how God saw it. Yes, and on top of that, there was a plague of dishonesty. He tells us about that in the early verses of chapter 7. There was fraud. They practiced deceit. There was burglary. Thieves break into houses. There were muggings. Bandits rob in the streets. And the philosophy of 8th century Israel was, if you want it and you can get away with it, take it. But you see what God comments. They don't realize that I remember all these evil deeds. Even if the forces of law and order are unable to cope with this tide of crime, I realize, I remember it. I don't overlook it. But no, the Israelites couldn't realize that, for God had been effectively eliminated from their worldview. For all their religiosity, there was no awareness in them at all of that personal obligation to his covenant law.
nor indeed any fear of his judicial sanctions for breaches of that covenant law. I suppose if it had been the ignorant masses only who were displaying this spirit of moral anarchy, there might have been some hope for them. But Hosea goes on to tell us it was just as bad at the top as it was at the bottom. Look at verse 3. They delight the king with their wickedness, the princes with their lies. They are all adulterers, burning like an oven, whose fire the baker need not stir from the kneading of the dough till it rises. It's not totally clear whether that simile of the hot bread oven in verse 4 is intended to be a picture of the sexual lust with which the young men of the royal court were characterized, or whether it's a picture of the seditious conspiracies that they were constantly fomenting there. Certainly, when you get down to verses 5 and 7, it seems pretty clear that the hot oven is cooking up not a sex orgy so much as a coup d'etat. On the day of the festival of our king, the coronation, the princes become inflamed with wine. He joins his hands with the mockers. Their hearts are like an oven. They approach him with intrigue. Their passion smoulders all night. In the morning it blazes like a flaming fire. All of them are hot as an oven. They devour their rulers. All their kings. A picture without any doubt, I think, of the years of political chaos that followed the death of Jeroboam II, when king after king was deposed by violence or built his throne by the ruthless extermination of his rivals. And it was all cooked up, he says, by these princes in the royal house. Even on the day of coronation, they were thinking of how they were going to get rid of him when opportunity came and put another man in his place. Somebody once asked an African in my hearing what form of government they had in his country, in Africa. And with his tongue in his cheek, he said, "It's tyranny moderated by assassination." Well, it would have been an accurate description of Israel in the middle of the 8th century. With six kings dying within the space of 14 years, it's little wonder that Hosea could say they devour their rulers, all their kings fall. But you see, once again, as in the case of the lawlessness of the general populace, these drunken and dissolute members of the royal house, they gave no thought at all to the moral implications of these revolutions that they were gingering up amongst themselves. And they gave no thought to that because they gave no thought to God. "All their kings fall," he says, "and none of them calls on me, the king." There's moral anarchy, you see. They had no awareness that there was any authority beyond that of the king they had just deposed. So from top to bottom, Israel was a corrupt society, though the loftiest moral standards in the ancient world were written into her national constitution. You would never have guessed it. So from top to bottom, Israel was a corrupt society, though the loftiest moral standards in the ancient world were written into her national constitution. You would never have guessed it. To look at her in the middle of the 8th century. In rejecting the covenant law of God, she'd opened the door to moral degeneracy. And God? Well, he was heartbroken about it. Go back to that verse we began with. "Whenever I would restore the fortunes of my people, whenever I would heal Israel, these sins of Ephraim are exposed, these crimes of Samaria are revealed." See, he longed to get his people back into a position where he could bless them, give them the prosperity and the future that he longed for to give them, to deliver them from their enemies, to fulfill the hope of that penitential psalm even that they sang at the beginning of chapter 6. "He has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he will bind up our wounds." But, says God, "no sooner has mercy triumphed in my heart, no sooner am I ready to restore their fortunes and heal their wounds, as that song says, they slap me in the face again with their flagrant contempt for my moral standards. And omnipotent as I am, I cannot bless a people like that, even though I want to. I can only grieve at their frustration of my desire to be gracious to them." Isn't that an extraordinary thought? I think if the shallowness of Israel's religion was a lesson to us as a church, and the corruption of Israel's society, that must be a lesson to our nation. You must forgive me if I read you a little bit from New Society.
few years ago. Some of you may be offended by the frankness of this article. It's written by a young lady called Eileen Fairweather. She's called it The Law of the Jungle. Gingerly, I took out my earplugs, hoping that the screaming from a few streets away had stopped. It had. But from the dark alley directly beneath my bedroom window came the grunts and obscenities of several men having sex with just one woman. Torn between exhaustion, concern, and seasoned cynicism, I wondered whether to call the cops or just take another sleeping pill. Duty one, perhaps because I'm a woman and several of my neighbours had recently been sexually attacked. Going to the window, I steeled myself to work out whether this gangbang was rape, business, or pleasure. A few sickening moments were enough to convince me that my sisterly intervention wasn't called for. The woman sure as hell wasn't enjoying herself, but she was earning her nightly bread. It was business as usual. On the local scale of tension here, being forced to overhear a gangbang rates as only a minor disturbance. In the Victorian streets behind the station, you can buy heroin and cocaine, a killer, or the body of a 12-year-old girl, if you want it. For several years, I've lived on this estate, where pimps and prostitutes, petty crooks, and plain and simple antisocial thugs have increasingly made their base. The many old people and young single women here live in a state of permanent fear. Out of just over 1,000 residents, hundreds have been robbed or burgled, almost all the women sexually molested, and one old man and one young woman brutally murdered. In the street, old Sal asks me, lip trembling, was I too woken up by last night's shooting, the screams and then the sirens? And what do I think of it all? Useless to tell Sal that it's slums and poverty which cause crime. She's been poor all her life and never hurt anybody. Useless even to tell her that the prostitutes are her sisters in a feminist struggle. They jostle her in the street, shock her with obscene oaths, laugh at her little dog. Nowadays, Sal's even scared for her. Some of the assaulted local thugs tortured her neighbour's pet. So hang 'em and flog 'em all, cries Sal. Strong-arm solutions appeal when you're powerless, and no one seems to be offering anything else. Night after night, when I've been kept awake by the pushers, cock rock, and drunken parties, I've been consumed by terrible, vengeful fantasies about how one day I'll castrate them, kill them, torment them, as they've for so long tormented and terrified me. Being female, of course, I'll do no such thing. But I do now understand how the law of the jungle infects and corrodes even those who are trying to resist it. The reason I most want off this estate is that I swear to God it's turning me into a fascist. Very frank words. Do you know where she lives? Just behind King's Cross Station. Scarcely 50 miles from here. Sheltered in the tranquility of our medieval quads and our riverside commons, many of us just do not understand the rot that has set into our society. Secularization has stripped us of the cogency of the moral law. As the Bible puts it, there is no more any fear of God before their eyes. And when there's no fear of God before people's eyes, people do as they like. The only way of imposing moral order on a society which is secularized in that way is the fascist way, by the will of a ruthless and repressive regime. The only alternative is moral anarchy. And already, huge tracts of our inner cities are in a state of anarchy. Of course, unemployment and racial tension make it worse. But it is the moral decay which is the tap root of our problem. And it only needs that moral gangrene to infect the parliamentary benches and the civil service offices, and Britain will be as corrupt root and branch as Israel was in the 8th century. I don't think it will take long to get there. Could it be God is saying to us, even as he said to them, Whenever I want to restore the fortunes of this people, whenever I want to heal them, the sins of Britain are exposed, and the crimes of London are revealed. Could it be our nation is fast becoming as much a disappointment to him as Israel was? But then that brings us to the third element in his disappointment in our passage. And that's the ingratitude of their infidelity to him. Look at verses 8 to 10 of chapter 7. Ephraim mixes with the nations. Ephraim is a flat cake not turned over. Foreigners sap his strength, but he doesn't realize it. His hair is sprinkled with gray, but he doesn't notice. Israel's arrogance testifies against him, but despite all this, he doesn't return to the Lord, his God, or search for him. And those of you who were here last week will remember that a political emergency was arising on Israel's doorstep as Hosea is writing this prophecy. The big powers of the Middle East were mobilizing themselves for expansion, and the peace and the prosperity that Israel had been enjoying for a number of years, it was all thrown into jeopardy. God had hoped, it seems, from what Hosea says, that this international crisis would shake Israel out of her infatuation with idols, call her back to the roots of her national religion, if only for motives of patriotism. But alas, it wasn't so. The only thing her weak and vacillating rulers could think of doing in response to this political situation was to play diplomacy with the giants. And that's what Hosea is referring to in these verses. He uses a number of interesting metaphors, doesn't he? He talks about Ephraim mixing with the nations. It's a culinary term, like the way you mix sugar and flour in the cake mixer. So he says Israel is prepared to lose her national identity just for the sake of a little bit of military security, being in it with others. Israel, he says, is a flat cake not turned over. In other words, a pancake that somebody's forgotten to turn over, cooked on one side, or burnt rather, and raw on the other. So he would say Israel's international policy is half-baked. All it will produce is indigestible cinders. I rather like the picture of verse 9, too, of advancing senility. Do you get it? Just like a man growing old and flabby, but not willing to admit it. So he says Israel's fallen policy is sapping her national strength. She's becoming a political geriatric, and she isn't even aware of it, he says. And then there's that lovely picture in verse 11. Where he likens her to a frantic bird of very little brain, flapping its wings in panic, desperately trying to get somewhere, and flying straight into the hunter's net as a result. Ephraim is like a dove, easily deceived and senseless, now calling to Egypt, one of her allies, you see, now turning to Assyria, when she got fed up with Egypt. When they go, I will throw my net over them and pull them down like birds of the air. Because, you see, as far as God was concerned, all this political shenanigans wasn't just incompetence, it was infidelity. Her turning to these pagan allies, Egypt and Assyria, was because she no longer trusted him. He does not return to the Lord his God, he says in verse 10, or search for him. In fact, in verse 16, he uses another metaphor. He says she's like a faulty weapon, a faulty bow that injures the one who tries to use it. So Israel, he says, is biting the hands of the one who really feeds it. Because of this, he says, the leaders will fall by the sword. Their land will be ridiculed in Egypt. That's an irony, isn't it? A very pagan nation to whom she turned for military assistance would in the end just laugh at her. But what a comment on God's sense of grievance that is. That he would rather allow the world to mock his covenant people than bless them in their rebelliousness. Yet make no mistake about it. The thought of having to punish his people in that way was very painful to God. It was a bitter disappointment. You see what he says in verse 13? I long to redeem them, but they speak lies against me. Or verse 15, I train them and strengthen them, but they plot evil against me. There's pathos there, isn't there? It's a bitter thing when a child upon whom you've lavished care and attention turns and spits in its parents' face. But that's what Israel was doing. God had been so good to her. I was the one who developed her, he said, who trained and strengthened her. And what's more, I want to go on being good to her. I long to redeem her, to buy her back from this self-inflicted bondage she's got herself in. But instead of the heartfelt prayers of repentance and entreaty that I long to hear, what do I get? Why, he says in verse 14, they wail upon their beds, they gather together, or perhaps slash themselves for grain and new wine. This is pagan prayer and self-mutilation that was characteristic of Baal worship, you see. Well, the justice of God can decree only one end for a people as treacherous and as ungrateful as that. Woe to them, he says. Destruction to them. They have rebelled against me. We've thought about the lesson which God's disappointment with her shallow religion has for us as a church. We've thought about the lesson which his disappointment with her moral corruption has for us as a nation. Can I finally suggest to you this morning that this concluding section of our study has a most powerful and important lesson for us as individuals? See, look again at what he says in verse 13. I long to redeem them, but. Who could ever believe there could be a but in the heart of God? A frustration. I long to redeem them, but. Can you believe, perhaps, that even this morning, this omnipotent God longs to redeem you? But. He's blessed you in all kinds of ways already, you know, if you did but know it. The trials he's seen you through, the successes you've achieved, you couldn't have done it without him. But what's been your response to all that goodness he's shown you? I long to redeem them, he says, but they speak lies against me. I trained them and strengthened them, but they plot evil against me. You think God is indifferent to that kind of ingratitude? Do you think it doesn't disappoint him? The BBC had a little competition recently and called it writing a mini-saga. You had to compose a story in 50 words. One of the highly commended entries went something like this. Nice to have you back, son. Nice to be back, Dad. Sorry they gave you such a hard time, son. You told me what it would be like, Dad. You told me it would be tough. The strange thing is, when it came to the crunch, it wasn't the nails, it was the kiss. You get that? It wasn't the nails, it was the kiss. Do you think that could have been true? That the cross hurt Jesus less than Judas's betrayal? Perhaps it was so. For there is no suffering like the pangs of disappointed love. To have been so close to a man, and yet to know he speaks lies about you, that he plots evil against you. Maybe it is true that nails through the hands are slight wounds in comparison to such a stab in the back. Could it not be that all of us are Judases? Could it not be there is something of that in us here this morning? Could it not be that the very devotion we've sung to him in our hymns this morning are little more than traitor's kisses? Never mind about the cant and hypocrisy in the church. How shallow is our religion? Never mind about the moral corruption in the country. How upright are our lives? Never mind about the ingratitude of others. How grateful are we to this God who is even now saying to us, I long to redeem them. Perhaps it is true. Perhaps Jesus is hurt more by those that just pretend to love him than he is by the world that is open in its hatred of him. It wasn't the nails. It was the kiss. What can I do with you, Ephraim?
What can I do with you, Judah? Whenever I would restore the fortunes of my people, whenever I would heal Israel, the sin of Ephraim is exposed, the crimes of Samaria revealed. I long to redeem them. But it is a startling thought that puny creatures like you and I can disappoint omnipotence. But we can, you know. Be warned by Hosea. Though that power lies within us, it still remains a most dangerous experiment to try. Let's pray together.